things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
In this case, cumulative resentments from years of partisan trench warfare were too great. Instead of the Senate forcing us to change, senators have decided to change the Senate. And I worry a great deal about what that means for our future.
Our Democratic colleagues have done something today that is unprecedented in the history of the Senate. Unfortunately, it has brought us to this point. We need to restore the norms and traditions of the Senate and get past this unprecedented partisan filibuster.
That is Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, each blaming the other's party for what happened in the Senate today. It is historically unprecedented. There's no doubt about it. Since 1789, I believe, there has been a Senate rule in one form or another allowing a filibuster basically to shut down debate or to continue debate, depending on how you want to look at it, and kill possible bills and things like that. And of course, it had been reserved almost exclusively now for Supreme Court nominees, Neil Gorsuch being one of them, the threat of a filibuster, and then what is called the nuclear option. We're going to find out what happened in the Senate today. Greetings and welcome. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live from the studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. This is Issues Etc. Mark Hemingway will be our guest for the first few minutes to talk about an update on Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court confirmation. Robert Morrison joins us after that. There's a French law banning online pro-life communications that has come before, well, the equivalent of the Supreme Court in France. We'll talk about that. Brian Ketchelmeyer will be our guest for Christ in the Old Testament. Hosea chapters 2 and 3 will be the subject of our conversation. And then Terry Mattingly will answer the question, what value or values drive Fox News, in the last half hour of Issues Etc. Feel free to join us with your questions or your comments over the course of the next 2 hours. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at IssuesETC, and the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us for an update on Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court confirmation, Mark Hemingway, senior writer for the Weekly Standard, based in Washington, D.C. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
So in non-Senate terms, this is hard to figure out from the audio from the Senate floor, what happened today in the U.S. Senate?
Well, the actual parliamentary procedures are so technical, it's really not even worth trying to explain it. I'm not even sure I fully understand it. But basically, the deal is this, is that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader for Republicans, initiated the quote-unquote nuclear trigger, which is to say that through a complicated parliamentary process, they initiated a process to change the rules in the Senate because they could not get 60 votes for cloture to vote on the Supreme Court nominee, then that means they are voting party line vote to change the rules of the Senate so that it no longer requires 60 votes to confirm a Supreme Court justice. Already, the filibuster was on its way out. I mean, for years, the filibuster was known as the soul of the Senate. You know, the idea that they offered a certain amount of deference to the minority party, for a higher than majority vote threshold on important decisions was kind of something that really made the Senate stand out, especially compared to the House, and was supposed to encourage, more thoughtful and civil discourse when they went about legislating. In 2013, Harry Reid, who was then the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, decided that he was going to get rid of the filibuster for executive appointments and and I believe most federal judicial nominees. So, I mean, already the filibuster had, you know, was basically already nuked. This was just sort of the nail in the coffin. And, you know, even prior to this, when Democrats were in power, were already threatening to do this on Supreme Court nominees themselves. The Republicans just felt that they had no choice to go ahead and do this and get their justice confirmed.
So what happens next?
Well, Republicans are just going to vote on party line, and they're going to confirm Neil Gorsuch and put him on the Supreme Court. I mean, that's really all there is to it. But at the same time, I mean, I you know, you have to be pretty sympathetic to Republicans in the sense that the fact they actually filibustered Gorsuch was really strange, because the odds are Trump's going to have another Supreme Court vacancy to fill, and it would have been a lot smarter to, you know, if you're going to insist on holding the filibuster, to, you know, assert that right on the second justice instead of, you know, making a big deal out of a guy who is popular, a popular nominee as Neil Gorsuch is. Not only that, there are three Democrats that are set to vote for him because they represent states that Trump won by large margins. So, you know, it looks like they're throwing a temper tantrum by not supporting a justice who is going to get, you know, passed into, is going to be confirmed to the Supreme Court on a bipartisan basis. So it's really kind of a strange play. But I guess the Democratic base is so angry right now in the Trump era that they're simply not allowing Democrats to behave reasonably on this.
Well, one bit of analysis that I read earlier today simply said this is a classic example of short-term thinking, because of course Neil Gorsuch would take the seat once occupied by the late Antonin Scalia. Politically, it's a wash.
Yeah, on the court. Doesn't change the balance of power on the court.
And the next one probably, most likely, will change the balance of power. So, beyond the anger of the Republican base, did Barack Obama's last nomination for the Supreme Court have something to do with this?
I mean, I think that that's part of it, certainly. I mean, Democrats have made big hay out of the fact that Republicans even refused to have refused to hold a vote for Merrick Garland, who I think, you know, as far as Democratic justices go, was a reasonable, you know, within the mainstream for a Democrat nominee. But the fact of the matter is that there is a history of not voting on Supreme Court justices that are nominated in the final year of a president's term. There is something to be said for letting the voters weigh in on the court in that sense. But the main thing is, I think simply that Democrats are so overconfident about Hillary Clinton's victory, and the fact of the matter is the Democratic base doesn't care about the Supreme Court the way that pro-life activists and other people that make up the conservative Republican base care about the composition of the court. I mean, they really seem to care about it more passionately. And so the fact of the matter is Barack Obama and the congressional Democrats really didn't expend any great amount of political capital last year trying to make sure that Merrick Garland got, you know, voted in. They just took it for granted that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And not only that, if Hillary Clinton won, I think a lot of them were thinking, well, we don't have to nominate Merrick Garland. We can nominate someone who's even more liberal and, you know, more ideologically friendly to, you know, the left-wing base of the Democratic Party. And that just didn't happen. And now they're outraged about it ex post facto. So it rings kind of hollow for a lot of Republicans to hear that complaint.
You mentioned that the filibuster and all the complex parliamentary procedure that surrounds it it comes down to being a Senate rule. It's not something that you can read about in the Constitution. It's simply these House rules that the Senate kind of lives by, and that it had been on the wane for some time. Where did it come from? Why before you referred to it or quoted someone referring to it as the soul of the Senate?
Well, if you really want to delve deep here, the filibuster started with Cato the Younger trying to stymie Julius Caesar in ancient Rome. But it's always been this sort of like weird feature that has popped up in different parliamentary systems. You know, they had various rules about completing business within a certain period of time or a day. And so there was always just sort of this, it was one way people saw to like stop legislation from being passed rashly. I think in the context of America, I'm not like a legislative expert on this, but we did not have a filibuster in America until about 1850, and I don't think it got applied to judicial or Supreme Court nominations till much later than that. Even it was strengthened to a degree in 1975 or something like that, but obviously the filibuster seemed like a much more useful tool when both of the parties were sort of closer together. I mean, it was only used in very extreme circumstances. But, you know, when you see something like, you know, someone like Neil Gorsuch being, you know, filibustered, you know, Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, the two people that Barack Obama did put on the Supreme Court, both of those got, I think Kagan got 5 Republican votes and Sotomayor got like 9 Republican votes, and neither one of them were filibustered. So there's no argument that either one of those justices is less radical or more mainstream than Neil Gorsuch. The fact of the matter is that we've reached a point, I think, ideologically where, I mean, there's not a single, you know, Democratic senator right now you could put a microphone in front of and, you know, say, name me 2 pro-life justices that you would vote to put on the Supreme Court. I mean, just the politics of abortion in particular and a number of other, you know, sort of big government issues for Democrats are so toxic that they just can't concede these issues anymore. So the filibuster has effectively become useless in that environment. There's just no justices that, you know, Democrats are going to confirm, so that don't fit a specific ideological criteria. So either we have to nuke the filibuster altogether, or you're just going to have to, you know, get an unnaturally large margin of votes in the Senate that we haven't seen in, you know, decades, really.
There are those who are concerned that this kind of gradual erosion of the filibuster makes the Senate more like the House of Representatives, more majority-driven, and things like that. What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, the House is basically a free-for-all. You know, that's kind of the way it was designed. You know, it's just corral as many votes as you need to pass something by hook or by crook and, you know, whip the votes and get it done. The Senate was supposed to be a sort of check on that. It was supposed to be, you know, an elevated version of the House in the sense that there would be more deliberation, you know, because of the more selective nature of the people that serve in it, and the fewer seats, you know, the people theoretically would be of a higher stature, you know, intellectually and otherwise, and the Senate would be able to have, you know, the kind of, you know, august debates that would represent, to quote, the world's most, you know, greatest deliberative body, or whatever the nickname for the Senate is. But, you know, here we are. Politics have been so rancorous for so long that, you know, there's just no place for that anymore. I mean, it's kind of sad that we are moving to a place where more and more things are done by sort of raw party line, small d democratic power. And I think that, you know, that's a slippery slope that, you know, we should all be pretty wary of, but it is what it is.
Mark Hemingway is our guest, senior writer for the Weekly Standard based in Washington, D.C. We're getting an update on Neil Gorsuch's Supreme Court confirmation on the other side of the break. What does the long-term impact look like after the nuclear option has been triggered for both political parties?
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Tired of mommy bloggers telling you Lent is about simplifying your life? Totally over the History Channel speculating on whether or not Jesus' skin was olive or white? Check out the April The Lutheran Witness. We're talking Lent, Easter, and Jesus, who hangs on a cross for you, lies in a tomb for you, and is risen and returning all for you. Visit cph.org/try-Lutheran-Witness for a special offer of 6 issues for $6.99. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Reformation was an attempt to answer the most fundamental questions of life then, and those questions endure today.
Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about his presentation at this summer's Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Who is God? Who am I? Where is God found? What does God make of us? Who is Christ? What's the purpose of my life? Why does suffering happen? all those questions remain absolutely pertinent, and the answers that were given in the Reformation are absolutely relevant today.
You can meet and hear Pastor Matt Harrison making the case for the Reformation's relevancy at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference in Collinsville, Illinois. For more information, call 618-223-8385 or visit issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard is our guest. We're getting an update on the Gorsuch Supreme Court confirmation. Okay, so what does the long-term impact of implementing this nuclear option look like for both parties, starting with Republicans?
Well, I don't think it looks much different than it does now. I mean, I was already mentioned Harry Reid and the Democrats got rid of the filibuster for most things back in 2013, and we've been living with that ever since. And I think it was obvious now for a while that, you know, this was going to happen one way or the other, whether the Democrats did it or whether the Republicans got rid of it on Supreme Court nominees, the filibuster was going to go away for that too. Having said that, you know, when I say it doesn't look much different the way things look now, I mean, I think a lot of people are looking around at the political rancor in the situation right now and saying, if we're going to extend this kind of political atmosphere in perpetuity, that is not a good thing. So there's going to be the main consequence is simply going to be that every, you know, Senate election and every presidential election going forward is going to be much more of a referendum on the Supreme Court. We kind of already saw that last year with Donald Trump. I mean, I think maybe one of the single biggest reasons he got elected was the court. You know, Donald Trump promised conservatives that he would get them a good, solid Supreme Court justice, and he's delivered on that promise now, and that was one reason why a lot of evangelicals and religious people were able to hold their nose and vote for Trump, because they thought that they could get another pro-life justice on the court. And, you know, here we are. But, you know, this has also come at a cost, you know. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen for a lot of things from here, but it's definitely going to, we're going to be hearing a lot more about the Supreme Court in every, you know, big election for sure.
We already heard before the nuclear option was exercised over the last week or so, just kind of simple, kind of hardball political threats from the Democratic leadership saying the Republicans will rue the day that they do this. What exactly do they mean by that?
Well, I mean, you can't expect to be in power forever. I mean, the Democrats nuked the filibuster because I think they really were arrogant and they believed that they had this like demographic coalition of the ascendant that they were calling it. And they thought that Obama coalition was, you know, going to keep them, you know, in the White House forever so that they didn't have to worry about, you know, the Republicans in Congress doing too much to interfere with the composition of the court. And they were wrong about that. Same thing now. I mean, even though the Republicans have a historically large majority in Congress, you know, obviously Donald Trump is not doing well in the polls, and we're one election or two elections away from, you know, the situation being completely reversed. And Republicans might want, you know, that power and courtesy extended to the minority party, where they have some sort of say over major decisions like Supreme Court nominees that the filibuster provided. However, one way of looking at it is, I don't know if you guys have ever had Ed Whalen on the show, but he is a sort of a judicial expert at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, who, you know, follows this stuff religiously, and he makes a very interesting point, which is that, as far as Ed is concerned, if you actually want conservative Supreme Court justices, this is all upside, basically, for conservatives and, you know, pro-life types, simply because, you know, as I pointed out, you know, Republicans are never going to historically have not filibustered mainstream Democratic justices, such as, you know, Kagan and Sotomayor and you know, heck, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I believe, was voted onto the court, I think, unanimously by Republicans at the time. So at the same time, we're rapidly entering a period where, you know, it is not acceptable in the Democratic Party for them to support basically any justice they think is going to be pro-life on the court. So, you know, what option do you have? I mean, you just, you know, get rid of the filibuster because it's the only way that you're going to get a conservative pro-life justice on the court.
Behind all that, why do Gorsuch's critics, why do they object to him serving on the Supreme Court?
Like I pointed out, I mean, it's a couple of things. One is that he is very much in the mode of Scalia, which is to say that he's an originalist and he believes that, you know, in sort of interpreting the Constitution, you know, reasonably strictly. But having said that, he's even more conservative than Scalia in one particular way, which is that there's a Supreme Court case. It's called Chevron for short. I forget what the full title of the Supreme Court case is, but it basically established this precedent where executive agencies get really wide latitude in interpreting regulations in terms of enforcement and in terms of crafting regulations and enforcing regulations. And Gorsuch has been very critical of this. And if you are a big government liberal, having this sort of permanent fourth branch of government, which is, you know, what political scientists call the administrative state, which is, you know, the executive agencies, you know, with, you know, 1.5 million bureaucrats constantly crafting, you know, new laws that, you know, by themselves that were never voted on by Congress, you know, it's been resulting sort of a death of 1,000 cuts, you know, to the freedom of, you know, a lot of ordinary Americans and American businesses. And Gorsuch seems to have signaled pretty strongly in his legal rulings in the past that he wants to rein this in. He wants to force Congress to be the legislative body and force the government to be accountable for all of the regulations and laws that it passes, instead of just pawning everything off on unelected bureaucrats to, you know, impose their will on the lives of ordinary Americans. So that's another big thing, you know, in addition to the fact that Gorsuch has, you know, he's actually been fairly silent on abortion itself, but he did write a book on euthanasia, which was sort of a very crafty thing to do. He's come out very strongly against euthanasia. The book he wrote is argued strictly on secular philosophical grounds, but nearly every argument he makes against state-sponsored euthanasia and everything can almost be directly applied right over to abortion. So I think it's pretty clear, although, you know, we've been disappointed by Supreme Court justices in the past that we thought were conservative and got on the court and didn't rule as such. It seems pretty clear that Gorsuch is very strong in both of those issues, and that has a lot of Democrats nervous.
Well, I guess in that vein, with only about 20 seconds, are you confident that Gorsuch will be a strict constructionist like Scalia?
He has a much larger paper trail than a lot of Supreme Court justices that have been put on the court and you know, sort of proven to be, you know, different than what people had in mind before they, what their agenda was before they got on the court. So I'm more confident than most, but after John Roberts has done some of the things that he's done and everyone thought he was a pretty solid conservative justice, you know, never say never, I guess.
Mark Hemingway is senior writer for the Weekly Standard based in Washington, D.C., and he'll be speaking along with his wife, Molly, at the Winter 2017 Issues, Etc., Making the Case Conference, Friday, November the 10th, and Saturday, November the 11th in Houston, Texas. You can find a list of topics and speakers, and you can also register at issuesetc.org. The Winter Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, and our Summer Making the Case Conference, June 9th and 10th in Collinsville, Illinois. Mark, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks again.
Robert Morrison joins us on the other side of the break. We're going to talk about a French law banning online pro-life communications. Many are noting that France, sometimes touted as the as one of the epicenters of liberty in the 18th century, is cutting back on that commodity. We'll be right back. The world may tell us that Easter is about eggs and chocolate bunnies, but we Christians know that there would be no Easter without Jesus' death and resurrection. Emmanuel Press has just released an Easter card with beautiful artwork that confesses Christ's victory over death and his redemption of mankind. You can find this card and others at emmanuelpress.us, E-M-M-A-N-U-E-L press.us.
People are talking about the Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Lutheran FCU was created solely to serve LCMS workers, families, and entities, and proceeds benefit LCMS organizations. Lutheran FCU offers deposit accounts and loans and has service access at thousands of branches and ATMs nationwide. Lutheran FCU also offers members Christian-based lending advice for new loans and refinancing, minimal account fees, and superior personalized service. Check them out at LutheranFCU.org.
The 500th anniversary of the Reformation approaches. A good time to ask, who are we as confessional Lutherans? What's our heritage? the Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission has produced the Layman's Guide to Theological History. Go to the CLCC.org and see which of these presentations and books would be most helpful to you and your fellow parishioners. And consider becoming a member with us as the CLCC seeks to help more people know what it means to be a confessional Lutheran. The CLCC.org.
When a Christian woman is critical of her own flesh, she holds her Creator in contempt.
Rose Adel from her new book, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Our Heavenly Father knit us together in the womb. He did not do a bad job. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 139:14. That goes for everyone, including the one who thinks she's the ugliest of them all.
You can purchase and download Concordia Publishing House's new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically, at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.